Our last speaker is one of our leading foreign correspondents and writers. He spent 25 years as a foreign correspondent in conflicts around the world, and his books include books about the Royal Air Force during World War II, Fighter Boys and Bomber Boys, Three Para, the British deployment to Afghanistan, The Man Who Was Saturday, about Mary Neave, and his latest book, which has just come out to chime with the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Paris, is Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory. Ladies and gentlemen, Patrick Bishop.
Thank you, Harry. I'm just using old-fashioned paper. I see Willie didn't use any notes at all. Sonia used a phone. I'm old school, so you're going to have to bear with me as I turn the pages. On the subject of Pamela Harriman, when I was based in Paris for the Telegraph, I was flush enough to join the Ritz Health Club, and I used to go down and swim in the morning in the Ritz, and there, Pamela Harriman, we sort of doing her lengths up and down alongside me. I felt very privileged. Even at that, she must have been getting on a bit then. And she still certainly had some allure, and indeed she died in that very, or had a fatal heart attack, I believe, or embolism or something in that very pool. That's just by the way. Like Willie, I'm going to ask you a question. Is there anybody here who doesn't like Paris, who doesn't like the city of Paris? No one. What a surprise. But it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, after all these years, after all the competition that Paris now gets from other cities, it's still got a place in our hearts. And I think, like Paris, you're going to like this book. So it's about many things. It's about liberation, but to understand the liberation, you have to understand the years that went before. So a lot of it is about French society, French politics, done, I hope, in as entertaining a way as possible. So it's about resistors, about collaborators, about heroism, about cowardice, and as the subtitle says, the shame and the glory of that liberation story of those incredible days, just about 80 years ago. But at the core of this story is, of course, the city itself. And I lived there at various times over my life, I think for a total of about 8 or 9 years, and I know it pretty well, warts and all, and there are, as anyone who knows Paris, it's not without its flaws. But nonetheless, I remain a fan. And I think, I was most recently, I was living there with my family from 2016 onwards for 4 years. But every morning, when we had this rather fancy apartment in the 8th arrondissement, and every morning when I walked out of those heavy porte-cochere doors into the street, I felt the same kind of buzz as when I first went there all those years ago. When I was lad of 17, hitchhiked there with a mate. We got the boat train to Calais, and I can remember the boat pulling into Calais. It was like those old Jean Gabin black and white movies of the 1930s. I remember seeing the Pelforth beer sign, illuminated beer sign, shining on the cobblestones. It was a wet evening, and feeling that kind of that sense of, you know, adventure and sort of otherness, I suppose. And the smell, the first thing that used to hit me then was the smell. It was a kind of mixture of Gauloise, Caporal tobacco, and drains, and that's gone. anyway, I mean, the time we spent in Paris was very light on culture, but a lot of kind of hanging around in bars, trying to talk in our schoolboy French to the girls we came across, with zero success, I have to say. But it started off in a sort of strange circumstance. We hitched and we arrived in Paris at nightfall. And as we dotted down by the side of the river, we saw what we thought was the Eiffel Tower in the distance. And we thought, great, this is it, we're here. And then when dawn broke, we saw in fact it was an electricity pylon. So, I mean, Paris was, London in those days, it's not that long ago, so that, what are we talking about here? About 1970, I suppose. London still had bomb sites in those days, big sort of gaping holes in the townscape where the Luftwaffe bombs had dropped. But Paris was still remarkably intact, and you didn't really get any sense of the war there. But bit by bit, I noticed these little plaques set in the wall. Everyone has seen them, I'm sure, on their trips to Paris, these little marble, rather discreet marble monuments which say ici est tombé so and so a man or sometimes a woman, often very young, mort pour la France. And so that sort of gave me an idea of the drama of the liberation. And the liberation really was a big, big thing. And when you think about it, Paris held this, because Paris held this special place in the world's imagination, the fate of other big European cities, Warsaw, Amsterdam, they didn't mean as much as the fate of Paris. So when Paris fell, without a shot being fired, it must be said, the behavior of the French army is one of the elements of shame that I write about in the book. Half the world, the free world, mourned, because Paris wasn't just a place, it was an idea as much as anything. It was associated with pleasure, with creativity, with art, but also with tolerance, with love. And these were all the things the Nazis wanted to smash to pieces. So when it was freed again, it was as if a light had been switched on again. Suddenly, it looked like the nightmare that people, everyone had been living through for the previous 4 or 5 years, created by Hitler, was almost over, and people could start to think about the future, thinking about a good future where they could live their lives again, pick up the pieces of the old ones. So Paris was, of course, very much a city of spectacle, so that the business of the liberation was an immensely powerful scene. And I'm just going to read out a little reportage by the famous American war reporter, Ernie Pyle, who was there that day. And he wrote that it was a pandemonium of surely the greatest mass joy that has ever happened. We all got kissed until we were literally red in the face. I must say we enjoyed it. When the Jeep was simply swamped in human traffic and had to stop, we were swarmed over and hugged and kissed and torn at. Everybody, even beautiful girls, insisted on kissing you on both cheeks. The fact that I hadn't shaved for days and was grey-bearded as well as bald-headed made no difference. Now, incidentally, Pyle was greatly admired by Ernest Hemingway, who, of course, was also a war correspondent. He was there, and he features quite a bit in my story. And Hemingway sometimes used to introduce himself as saying, "Hi, I'm Ernie Hemeroid, the poor man's Pyle." Another description was supplied by J.D. Salinger, who was a young aspiring writer, but he arrived by jeep with the 4th Infantry Division, where he was serving as a sergeant in the counterintelligence unit. Now, he wrote back to a friend in New York that the crowds cried, they laughed, they besieged us, they brought bottles of cognac out to the jeep. It was really fine. There was still shooting in the streets, but nobody seemed to care. All the girls looked elegant and had put on their best August dresses. He felt that if we had stood on the hood of the jeep and taken a leak, Paris would have said, "Ah, the charming Americans, what a charming custom." So I wondered during the research what effect all this had on the birth rate, and I dug around in the records. Sure enough, 9 months later, it had jumped, and in one arrondissement, it had more than doubled. So there are lots of famous names in the story who all came together on those heady days, like Hemingway, Salinger, Picasso, but lots of more obscure but equally fascinating characters who represent all sides of the story: German and French collaborator, resistant, etc., ordinary folk you never have heard of, but who actually had very interesting wars. But as well as making babies, lots of myths were created that day. Most famous of all, the idea that Paris had liberated itself. Now, this was the work of Charles de Gaulle, who I was interested in. He was also smitten by Pamela Harriman. That must have been quite a feat, actually, to impress de Gaulle. But he seized this moment to establish himself as the leader of the new France, in effect by acclamation, as he walked down the Champs-Élysées. This is the day after the actual liberation, this is the 26th, Saturday, to the really hysterical cheers of crowds who until that moment had very little idea of what he looked like. To most of them, he was just a voice on the radio. Got to remember that France was already a very bitterly divided country. And as a result of the defeat, this catastrophic defeat, and the humiliation of the occupation, these divisions just got worse. And it was entirely possible, I think, that the liberation might actually have ushered in a civil war between the diehards of the collaborationist Vichy regime and the forces of Free France, represented and headed by de Gaulle. So this first speech, this first utterance that he made to the nation was of incredible importance. So he made it in the Hotel de Ville at Paris City Hall. And he declared that Paris had been outraged, broken, martyred, but now it was liberated. And he went on, it was liberated by itself, liberated by its people with the help of the armies of France, with the help and assistance of the whole of France. And he went on in this way. But of course, it was all nonsense. The armies of France, in this case, amounted to one armoured division, the Deuxième Blindée, commanded by Philippe Leclerc. But although the Brits were pretty annoyed about this, I can see entirely the necessity for this. This was a lie that had to be told to make Paris and France generally feel good about itself and plaster over the very deep cracks in society. And it worked. France went on to prosperity and arguably an undeserved place on the world stage. It's an extraordinary thing that the French, having contributed brilliantly to Allied victory, then had a place on the Security Council, etc., etc. But you only have to look at France now to see that it remains a disjointed, I suppose, is one way of putting it, a disjointed nation, a disjointed society. When I look at Marine Le Pen's National Rally, the vibe that I get from that is has a very strong whiff of Vichy about it. And when I look at Emmanuel Macron, I think dear old Emmanuel definitely fancies himself as a reincarnation of Charles de Gaulle. But having said that, the French have done a lot to come to terms with this painful passage in their history. I was talking about this with Harry earlier. We've got to give them credit for that. Naturally, these things take time. But over the years, they really have taken a pretty stern look at themselves and their conduct during that period. But it does still remain a touchy subject, which they understandably feel a little uncomfortable, but an outsider like myself starts to rake over it. So on the history of the book today, Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory, it's been published in Canada, the US, rights have been sold in Italy and elsewhere. But so far, not a sniff from a French publisher. But my wife suggested a solution. She said, it might be wiser if the author of the title went on. And she said, how about his career, Paris 44, The Glory? And that might get some takers. Thank you very much indeed.